Today we've got Kevin Bigger speaking with us. So Kevin was a couch potato before he was transformed into a world record beating endurance athlete. So Kevin managed to get off the sofa and take part in a 5,000 kilometer transatlantic rowing race. He'd never rowed before, and with Jamie Fitzgerald, his rowing partner, only joined the team 6 weeks beforehand, and they not only won, but they set a new world record for crossing the Atlantic. Now the pair went on to do a much tougher challenge. They walked unsupported from the coast of Antarctica to the South Pole, which is a 52-day, 1,200-kilometer journey, towing a 160-kilogram sled in temperatures as cold as minus 40 degrees. Pretty chilly. So Kevin's written a couple of books about his exploits and awesome adventures of a fat boy rower and escape to the pole. And Kevin and Jamie are also the hosts of the TV series First Crossings. Who's seen First Crossings? Good show, eh? Awesome show. So we've got Kevin along here to entertain us today and share what he's learned about facing challenges while rowing an ocean and trekking to the pole.
I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to
move it.
I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to
move it.
Awesome, so big welcome to Kevin Bigger.
Good to have you on board. There you go.
Thank you very much, that's very kind of you. Since I know you've come a long way, it's the end of a long week, it's the end of a long day, you've seen the plan, the only thing between you and drinks is me. So here's the deal, the more you laugh, the more you clap, the faster I'll speak. You're onto it! Fantastic. Now you know something about me, but I don't know anything about you. I have a way of finding out. In honour of the Super 12 rugby season, which is about to kick off in just a few hours' time, can you believe that? I have invented a game called the Sin Bin. Could you all please stand up? You're the All Blacks. You only play fairly. But I'm one of those officious Northern Hemisphere refs that keeps trying to find faults. So I'm going to ask you some questions. If the answer to the question applies to you, you have to sit down. You're in the bin. And once you're down, you stay down. Here we go. Now, in these days of Facebook, Twitter, and social media, there's often hacks into the cloud, so it's important as professional tradespeople that you keep your electronic lives squeaky clean. So sit down if you have a Justin Bieber song loaded on your phone. The plumbers coach team lost somebody just then. Very good, that was the right answer. Very good. The business world is moving at a faster and faster pace. Customers want their plumbing solutions ASAP. Now that's fine on the job site, not so good on the road. Sit down if you've got a, sit down if you or any of your team have got a speeding fine so far this year. This year. Last year, yeah, yeah, but this year, yeah, no, you're good, you're good. Right, being a successful plumber or any successful kind of businessman can mean a lot of late nights. That means, unfortunately, cutting down on your TV watching. Down if you've watched every episode of Game of Thrones. Or Downton Abbey. Tony's still standing up. We will get him. Right, we've just had the Cricket World Cup last year, and Shane Warne was a big part of that. And he was in the news about the same time because he broke up with Liz Hurley, who only ever goes out with handsome men. So she must have seen something in Shane. So sit down if you ever once thought that Shane Warne was hot. I'm not sure why I'm looking at you, sir. No, I didn't think I'd catch anyone out, but I'd ask it because a couple of months ago we moved house and I found to my horror that my wife owned a poster of Shane Warne. Wasn't above the bed or anything weird, but I'm looking forward to telling her that's not right. Good, now tradespeople are famous for their dry sense of humour. So sit down if you've ever sent the apprentice for the left-handed screwdriver or the long wait or, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Is that just this year?
No, not this year, the whole year, any time, yeah, yeah. Okay, all right, last question. If you're a royal fan, this is a fantastic time for you because we've had, just in the last year, Prince Charles, Kate and Wills, Prince Harry, all come out. So sit down if you've shaken the hand of a member of the British royal family. Well, my claim to fame is that I met Prince Charles once. It was in a room just like this. We were in lines. He was walking up and down, shaking our hands. And in fact, he was coming down the line, shaking hands. And then as I looked up, I saw to my horror, he was actually saying a few words to each of the people. I thought, gosh, I've got nothing to say to him. What do I possibly say to the future king? But as he shook the hand of the person next to me, I saw he had lots of whales on his tie. So I thought, right, when he came and shook my hand, I said, how come you have lots of whales on your tie? He said, because I'm the Prince of Wales, of course. That's my best stuff. I'm here for the next hour. Could you sit down and give yourself a big hand? Thank you very much. Oh, that was awful. I'd like to start by telling you about the worst time in either of these two adventures. And it was when I was 120 miles out from the end of the transatlantic rowing race, which in the terms of a 3,000-mile race is very nearly at the end, but still a lot more than you'd like to swim. And we're in quite big seas, which was great, because you'd see a swell coming in the distance. You'd start doing short, sharp strokes to build up speed. If you timed it just right, you'd get on the front of the wave. You'd start going 6 knots, 7 knots, 8 knots as the wave pushed you along, and it would lift you up. And then it would roar off to the southwest. You'd be left in this hissing pool of foam with your heart thumping. It was all great fun while the sun was out. Then the sun started to set, it started to get dark. And so I said to a mate, I said, maybe we should put our safety lines on. You know, they're the lines that connect you onto the boat. And he goes, oh, yeah. Maybe in the next shift. Well, just then a wave came along that was a little bit larger than all the rest. And we started to roar down the front of this wave, going faster and faster. We couldn't get the boat straight, though. It started to veer off to the right-hand side. Then the left-hand rail dug in, and we got flung out into the dark, churning water. So let's leave me out in the ocean for a bit and talk about you guys. Because you've got a lot more sense than to take on adventures like this, but you are on an adventure of your own as you get out of your comfort zones to apply some of the selling skills and the things that you've learnt during this course to give yourself the income and the lifestyle that you want. Then you're on an adventure, because the definition of adventure is simply to take bold and risky steps towards a worthwhile outcome. So there's no mention of ice or ocean in that. And you may not get as wet or as cold as me, but you'll face just as many sharks and icebergs on the way. So what I've learned doing my own adventures, in fact, it's not the physical side that makes it tough, it's the psychological side. And I think that psychological journey that you go through whenever you take on a big challenge, it's the same regardless of whether it takes place on the ice, on the water, or at a job site. So what I'd like to do over the next little while is to share with you what I think are the five hardest things about taking on any major challenge, and some of the tips and tricks that have worked really well for me. And along the way, we're going to row across an ocean, trek to the South Pole, give away a few books, and if it's okay with you, we'll have a couple of laughs as well. How does that sound? Good? Like I say, in honour of the Super 12, I'm going to do it with a rugby thing. First one, I've called it face the try line. You might think, well, what's so hard about that? What's so hard about just facing the goal that you've been set? Or the goal you've set for yourself? Well, a few years ago, I was going through a bit of a quiet patch. It was more like a quarter life crisis. I was trying to work out what I should do. I was in a job I didn't really like. I was trying to work out what I should do next. And I had all these helpful friends that would come to me and they'd say, oh, you should do this, you should do that. And I'd always have the same response. I'd always have the same kind of yeah, nah reaction. So at first I'd always be like, yeah, that sounds really cool, if it was a good idea. And then I'd very quickly think though, oh, no. Think of all the things that could go wrong. Think how risky it is. And with that kind of mindset, it was really easy to justify why I didn't need to change doing what I was doing. So I was stuck this way, unhappy, for months, even years went by. Until at last, something happened to me one night that finally knocked me off my perch. And I'm mentioning it because it's going to happen to you too. Because it happens once in every sports fan's life. Doesn't matter who your favourite team is. For me, it was the All Blacks, but it doesn't matter. Because one weekend, I remember very clearly, I was watching the All Blacks run out for the first time, and I had that moment that happens once in every sports fan's life when they see that they are, in fact, older than any of the players in their favourite team. Now, not that either wanted, you shouldn't laugh, it's going to happen to you too, unless bowls is your sport, and then you've got a bit longer. But not that I ever wanted to be an All Black, really, but suddenly in a flash I saw that I thought that I'd been playing it safe by not taking any risks. And then in a flash I saw I was doing the riskiest thing of all, because I was letting these opportunities go by without giving them any sort of consideration. And in fact, I was thinking like this guy. You see, from his point of view, he thinks that sitting on his bum is the best thing that he can do. But what we can see, that he can't see, is that he doesn't really have a sustainable position for the future. What he needs to do is stand up and make some tough calls, even though that might be a bit uncomfortable in the short term. So when I realised that I was living like this, I decided that I had to make some tough calls as well. I decided to sell my house, quit my job, leave my girlfriend, and go back home and live with my mum. Sat on mum's sofa, ate a huge amount of fast food, put on a lot of weight as I was trying to figure out what to do next. And the problem was, I still had that same mindset. So people would come to me, and my friends would be having a great time. They'd come to me and say, oh, you should do this, you should do that. I'd go, yeah, really cool. Oh, no, that's too hard. It's too risky. For example, I was watching the news one night, and I saw this clip about the last person to complete the transatlantic rowing race. And when I first saw it, I was very enthusiastic. I thought to myself, like some of you were thinking, I thought, I bet that's not as hard as it looks. So I did a bit of research and found, in fact, it's not as bad as you might think. For a start, you don't even have to go the whole way because you start off the coast of Africa, you finish off the coast of South America, and sure, it's 5,000 kilometres long, but here's the thing, there's two people in each boat. That means you only have to row half the distance. And it's not like you even need to take all the food you need for the trip because you can always fish when you're out there. In fact, you don't even need to take a fishing line because the fish just jump into the boat. And it's true at certain times of year, the wind picks up. And when the wind picks up, the waves can lap over the front of the boat. But it turns out the thing you have to be most worried about is, in fact, aliens. I'm deadly serious. You saw that our route just clips that part of the ocean where lots of boats and planes have gone missing at sea. It's called the Bermuda Triangle. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, a big tanker went down there. But often the boats and planes are found again afterwards, just without any crew on board. So one of the first things I did was to see how risky this race was to see how many rowboats have been lost rowing across the Atlantic. The answer is six boats. And when I say the boats are lost, here's the weird thing. They always find the boat again afterwards, just without any crew on board. That's weird, right? That's creepy. So I don't care if it's methane emissions or water spouts or aliens taking people up for science experiments. Clearly something really bad happens out there. So I quit. Thank you very much. I did quit. But then I thought, you know what? I'm sick of the way I keep quitting on these ideas. At least be rational about it. At least do a pros and cons list. So here it is. Do I row the ocean or not? If any of you are procrastinating about something big in your life, you might want to bring it to mind, because I bet the list of excuses that you're about to see is going to be the same as the excuses you've got. I started with the cons first, because all I could think of was reasons for not doing. Reasons for not rowing across the ocean, let me think. I could die. You know, there's six boats lost at sea. Now, if you've ever read any books about people who try and row across the ocean, then you've seen there's chapters and chapters about how painful it is, how the skin, the salt water exposure rots the skin, they get salt water boils, their hands get stuck in this rigid shape. It just sounds incredibly painful. I'm not into pain. These same books talk about these crazy shifts they do on the boat. Even though there's two people, one person rows, the other person sleeps, and then they swap. And it tends to be about 2 hours on, 2 hours off. So you can't fool me. That means you have to get out of bed six times a day. And at that time in my life, I was having a hard enough time getting out of bed once. Oh, there was something else. I think Tony might have mentioned it. I don't know how to row. So I've got a really good list of reasons. These aren't excuses. These are reasons for not taking part in the race. So this time, I really did quit. But then I had two things happen to me out of the blue that really changed the way I felt about taking on this race. And in fact, they've really helped me in all the challenges I've taken on since. Here's what they are. A couple of days after this, I went out to the letterbox, and inside was a large envelope. When I took it inside, I opened it up, and it turned out it was the application pack for the race. And I'd quit on the race, so I didn't really care. I was flicking through it. But then I turned the page, and there was this incredible image. It moved me so much that I cut it out and stuck it on the wall. Here it is here. Look at these two guys. Look how bronzed and buff they are. Look at the guns this guy's got. It was like getting a postcard from the future. It really breathed life into what I was trying to achieve. And I found that having an image is a very powerful way to keep your subconscious mind on track. It doesn't matter whether it's cut out from a magazine and put on the wall or a screensaver. on your laptop, or whether it's just something you think about every day. It's a very powerful way to keep your mind on track. Now, I'm not saying that anything mysteriously magical takes place just because you've got a picture. I mean, look at my wife. She had a poster of Shane Warne and she got me instead. But it is a powerful way to keep your subconscious mind on track. So I cut this out, I stuck it on the wall, I'm looking at it each day, I'm excited about the race now, and you've got to be excited about any challenge that you take on. But to be honest, I'm not making a lot of progress though, because I haven't dealt with the issue of the risk, this big downside, the fact that six crews have been lost at sea. And that got resolved in a kind of a strange way. I found myself on the phone talking to a guy in the UK who had just come back from a trip to Antarctica. He was a friend of a friend. Someone said, "You're thinking of doing stuff like this, why don't you call him up?" So I called him up. I didn't know what I was going to say to him, but I thought I'd start broad. So I said, "So what's it like down there?" And he said, "It's okay." And I thought, right, he's one of these tough adventurer types. You've got to be really specific with your questions. So I said to him, "Isn't it cold?" And never guess what he said. He said, "You know it's going to be cold. You take warm clothes." Which sounds really daft, right? Until I started thinking about it, I thought, actually, that's really profound. Because what he's saying, if you can foresee something that's going to make it difficult or painful or hard, then why don't you do something about that beforehand? It's certainly true in the adventure world. You spend a lot of time thinking before you jump on a plane about all the things that could go wrong and how you're going to stop them from taking place. True in the business world too, right? If you want to find a new way of doing something, you'll come to courses like this, you'll chat to people who might be using that system, or you'll see how it's been used overseas. There's lots of different ways you can take the risk in. I still see some blank looks, so let me give you an example. This is a mouse trap, right? This is bad if you're any kind of mouse, yeah? Unless you've done some of that plumber's coach thinking. Let's go back to that silly old list. Yes, you could die out there, but the boats are always found again afterwards. All you have to do is stay tied onto the boat and you'll be fine. I'm not into pain, it's true, but I've got 2 years before the next race. Why don't I just build the most comfortable boat in the fleet? I could bolt a lazy boy on if I wanted to. I don't get out of bed 6 times a day. Well, that's just changing my head, because in that same race, I get to go to bed 6 times a day. I could certainly handle that. I don't know how to row, that's true, but whenever you set off on a big, worthwhile task, a big challenge, you're not going to know all the steps from the start to the end. In fact, that's almost the definition. You may not be great salespeople now, for example, but you have to back yourself that you can learn or work with people who have those skills. I figured it didn't matter how bad I was at rowing across the ocean at the start of this race. By the time I got to the end, I was going to be an expert. On to the next hardest thing now. I've called it plan to win. You might think that's another strange one to have. Why would you take part in a race and not want to win it? But it turns out there's a big difference from when we go out to play on the weekend, or the Golden Oldies go out to play on the weekend, to when the All Blacks go out to play on the weekend. And that was brought home to me when I went and saw a sports coach. One of the first things I did was to lose some weight and get fit, and made an appointment to see a sports coach. And I walked up into his office, and on his desk he had my work plan or my training plan. He had all those little boxes with how many hours of what I should be doing each day. And he looked up from his desk and he says, "Oh, Kevin, I just need to know, for your training plan, are you going to win this race or are you just going to take part?" I thought to myself, gosh, it's a bit early to be asking me this. I've only just thought I'm going to be in the race. Why would I know if I'm going to win it? But I thought for a second, I said, look, I'm going to try really hard and I'll see what happens then. Which seemed a reasonable answer. But he turned on me though. He said, no, that's completely wrong. He said, the only chance you have of winning this race is if you decide to win. And everything will change about the way you prepare for this race if you decide to win. I don't care what it is, but I need to know now, are you going to win or are you just going to take part? So I said, okay, all right, crikey, I'll win. And it was as lame as that. But he was right. When I followed through, everything did change. The amount of time I spent trying to get experts to help me out, to the amount of cash I spent trying to shave a few grams of weight off the boat. And I know that if I'd just tried my hardest, I'd have actually made a lot of unconscious compromises between then and the point we put the boat in the water, not to mention the tactics we used in the race. Now, what this coach is saying is you don't have to win every event you're going into, but what he's saying is you need to be clear about what the objective is and work backwards from there with a plan, rather than just trying to do business as usual a little bit harder. And I wanted to use that same kind of thinking when I started planning my South Pole trek. So I did some research about Antarctica, which is an amazing place. Not just the coldest continent, on Earth. It's the highest, the driest, and the windiest place. I guess that makes it the most ist place as well. 90% of all the world's ice is locked up in these amazing ice sheets up to 5 miles thick. And 100 years ago, it was the scene of the great race between Roald Amundsen and Captain Scott as they set off from the Ross Ice Shelf and headed towards the South Pole. And who got there first? Roald Amundsen got there first. Captain Scott and his four friends arrived a couple of weeks afterwards, and they tragically died on the way back, just 100 or so miles out from the end and just 11 miles short of a big supply dump, which if they had reached it, they'd almost certainly have made it back. Instead, they died of hunger and cold, and there was a tragic loss. But that's March 1912. That's a long time ago. So I was very surprised to find myself having jam and tea, jam and scones, with the third person to lead a team overland to the South Pole. If you put up your hand and tell me who it is, I'll give you a copy of my book. Very unsurreal. Can we give you a big round? Can we give Lane a big round of applause? Yes, our very own Sir Ed, 1956 to 58, fresh back from climbing the highest mountain in the world. He was down in Antarctica leading the New Zealand part of a Commonwealth expedition. The New Zealand part was just to lay supply dumps off for an English guy who was attempting a transantarctic crossing from the other side. And New Zealand's last dump was a few hundred k's away from the pole. That was way too close for Sir Ed. So he switched off his radio in case he got any orders telling him not to, and decided he'd make a dash towards the South Pole. When he arrived, just with the smell of petrol in his tanks, and in so doing, became the third person to reach the South Pole overland. And we had some wonderful morning teas with Sir Ed because he kindly agreed to be the patron of our expedition. So we would talk about our plans, but mostly we'd just ask him about what it was like down there. And I remember very clearly the day I asked him, I said, so how cold does it get? You can tell I'm obsessed by this. He goes, oh, it gets very cold. I said, well, how cold? He said, gosh, on some days, he said, it got so cold that the petrol would freeze in the lines of the tractors. I said, what would you do then? He said, oh, would draw straws. The person with the shortest straw would get the blowtorch. It would be his job to unthaw the fuel lines, he said, while the rest of us stood well back. So there have been a lot of amazing trips done in Antarctica, but nobody at that point had done a really obvious one. Not an easy one, but a obvious one. And that's to go from the coast to the pole and back again, unsupported and unresupplied. So you start off with all the food and fuel you need in your sled. You tow it yourself. There's no horses or dogs. You tow it the 1,200 k's into the pole and the 10,000 feet high, because the South Pole's really high. And then we're planning to use snow kiting kites, very similar to the kite surfing kites, which I'm sure you've seen, to use the wind that always blows away from the pole to take us back out to the coast. Now, if you've ever read any books about people who do stuff like this, then you'll have come across the chapter where the two guys get out of the little sled, or rather out of the little plane that's take them to the coast of Antarctica. They hook onto their sleds for the first time, and then they moan about how heavy the sleds are. It's in every book. It's very strange. And when Jamie and I decided when we were going to be doing this, we said, that's not going to be us. We are going to train so hard that we're going to be a mountain of muscle when we hook onto that sled for the first time. There's going to be a big smile on our face. So I have here a clip of the very first time we trained with what we thought the wave was. Did a lot of training like this around Auckland and down in Wellington as well. You might have seen the sign even if you go around Shelley Bay, I think. We had to be discreet though. We knew how silly we looked and we tried to be discreet, but often at the end of the day when the exhaustion kicked in, you'd forget. And then you just have to listen to all the advice you're being shouted, particularly by young guys in cars. Perhaps the best piece of advice we got was, loser, with the rest of your car. Couldn't do all of our training down here. It doesn't get cold enough. We had to go up to the Arctic to learn how to take care of ourselves in that incredibly intense, poisonous cold that we're going to be experiencing down in Antarctica. We were back there a second time to learn how to snow kite. Only one rule of snow kiting, that's always keep your feet on the ground. Oh. On to the next hardest thing. That's getting the teamwork right. Now, you all work in teams or with teams, so you know what amazing things a high-functioning team can achieve. But some of you also, I'm sure, have had some problems with your teams. So how do you avoid that? Well, one of the most important things that you can do is at the start of the year or at the start of any big change, get all the people who are going to be affected in the room, all the team, signing off on what the purpose is and agreeing on what their role is. Certainly true if you want to row across an ocean. Put up your hand if you can guess who the hardest person to convince that rowing across the ocean is a good thing. Who said mum? Who? You? Very good. Can we give a big round of applause to Tracy? Yes, my mum, or my flatmate, as I like to call her, at the time. And she thought it was the most stupid idea that she'd ever heard. She told me every chance she had, she said, you're going to sea in a coffin. And we had row after row about this until one day she came to me, after some months, with this funny smug look on her face. And I thought something was up. I said, mum, what's up? She said, I think I found a way to resolve this dispute. I said, well, how? And she said, we're going to get a third party involved to arbitrate. I said, what, are we going to go like to the Citizens Advice Bureau? She said, oh no, we're going to the highest court in the land. Which in my mum's mind was the How's Life TV show. Now, for those of you who didn't have the lifestyle, we could watch a bit of telly in the middle of the day a few years ago. It's one of those Beauty and the Beast type shows where girls write in with questions about their boyfriends and they answer them for you. And mum was a huge fan of the show. So her whacked idea was this. She was going to write in with her question about whether or not I should go and let them decide. And if they said I could go, I'd go. If they said I'd have to stay, I'd have to stay. So I said, okay, anything to stop this. So a couple of weeks after that, we had all of our family and friends around in the lounge in a scene remarkably similar to this. And just before it went on air, I could tell mum was getting nervous. And I could tell this because she came up to me and she said, now all four of them have to agree. If any one of them say you can't go, you can't go. I said, okay, that's fine. So you can imagine the tension was pretty high as her question started to get answered.
How's life? My 33-year-old son now wants to compete in the transatlantic rowing race next year. This will take up all his time and savings. When it's over, he'll be broke, jobless, and probably still living at home with me. I think he should be building his career. How can I make him see reason? Concerned mother by email. Marcus, what does he do? Fulfill his ambitions?
You can just imagine if we were on the show 50 years ago on the radiogram, you know, dear How's Life, my son wants to throw in his beekeeping practice to climb Mount Everest, you know?
Yeah.
Can anyone here see any problem at all?
None.
Okay, Marcus, we've got a gay issue coming up soon, so you might want to belt up until that one's on.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah, I think she should be celebrating that this guy's busting
exactly.
Through. I mean, how boring life would be if he just keeps going the way he is.
Absolutely.
Good, she's got the problem with this. Yeah, I think he's right on track as far as I can see.
I'm concerned about concerned mother, quite frankly. She's got a son here who can take her for a row of an afternoon. And
no, it's go the rowing, go for it, do what you want. You've still got to talk to your mum.
No, I don't, because I've just won! Would you like to see a picture of mum? You don't have to. No, she's absolutely hideous. No, she's lovely. There she is. And while we're doing family pictures, here's my little boy. Isn't he good? He's sitting in a fry pan, you see? It's really cute. Anyway, you know how I said, if you don't know what you need to know, you can work with people who have those skills? One of the smartest things I did was to team up with Rob Hamill, who some of you might remember was the guy who first won the race with Phil Stubbs. And he wasn't keen to row a second time. Perhaps that should have given me a clue. But he was keen to help out with the hardest thing. The hardest thing, which might surprise you about rowing across the ocean, is trying to raise the sponsorship, trying to sell the race, trying to sell your boat and what your campaign is. By far the hardest thing. And if for those of you who are just learning selling skills, I have a lot of appreciation for that because it was tough for us, really tough. You started to make, we made excuses, and maybe they were good excuses, I don't know. For example, the Rugby World Cup was on at the same time as the race, so all the sponsors were looking over there. The two guys from Auckland who'd won the previous time, they were back, and so the sponsorship pool was sort of halved. The race takes place out in the middle of the ocean, so unless you can convince the sponsors that their customers are fish, you know, it's really hard to see what's in it for them. People need more plumbing services in their lives. They don't need another ocean rowing race in their life. But if I'm honest, I think the thing that made it particularly difficult for us as we tried to sell this race was the strange knack that we had of offending the people that we were pitching to. Now, I don't know whether you've covered this morning, but I want to give you three real-world examples of what actually happened to us to see whether you'd make the same mistake. This is like the graduation. It's the end of the day. It's the graduation part of the course. Here we go. First test. You're very lucky to get an interview with the CEO of Bell Tea. They're a great sports brand. They've supported horses for a long time, but why not rowboats? And they must have some interest because they said, sure, won't you come along? So we go into the boardroom there, beautiful walnut-covered boardroom table, very big leather-backed armchair with the CEO in it. He swings around. He says, guys, good to see you. Would you like a cup of tea or coffee? Do you see the trap? They're very well trained, Tony. You've done a great job. Yeah, we didn't. Right, next one. You're talking to the CEO of Microsoft. CEO of Microsoft down in Auckland, not Bill Gates, just the local guy. Very high pressure situation, hundreds of thousands of dollars on the line. Your laptop knows this because it's got that little chip inside that detects high pressure, gives you the blue screen of death. That's okay, you can still save it, but you've got a choice. Do you blame A, the software, or B, the hardware? Another mistake we made. Last one, Weet-Bix. We're very fortunate to get an interview with the marketing head of Weet-Bix, which is a fantastic sports brand. They've got the All Blacks on their back of their packs for months and months now. And again, they must have thought so because they agreed to see us. And so we, just before we went into the room though, the ad agency which had brokered the deal took us to one side and they said, guys, do you know Weet-Bix are owned by the Seventh-day Adventists? And we said, yep. And they said, you know, they're a pretty clean cut crowd. We said, yep. They said, so you just might want to watch your P's and Q's when you're in there. Well, of course, what would we possibly say that's offensive? So when a cup of hot tea falls into your lap in the middle of that presentation, what are the worst two words to shout out? You know, luckily what we lacked in charm, we made up for in persistence. And I really, what you were saying, what Tony was saying for about follow-up was really an important part of that. Because we just had to get one big sponsor on board. And if the thing that really slowed us down, if someone showed a little bit of interest, so not quite a no, but not a yes. You know, and that would really slow us down because psychologically you'd kind of commit to them and say, oh, it's kind of sorted. If I get two or three, you know, there's two or three people who are thinking about it, so something, one of them's got to land. And we just kept on persisting and persisting, trying to get a no. We were bagging the no's as many as we could. We weren't trying to not get sponsorship, but we knew it was just a matter of crunching through the numbers. You know, if we made enough approaches and got turned down enough, we would get somebody. And eventually it happened. And it wasn't long before we found ourselves at the start of the transatlantic race, 16 other boats there on a hot, calm, still day, with my blood absolutely fizzing because I'm about to row across the ocean with someone who I've only just met. You see, I spent all year leading up to the start of the race training with this other guy, and then just 3 weeks before we were due to fly out, he'd called me up, he'd hurt his back, he wasn't going to be able to make it, which left me scurrying around trying to find somebody else. Turns out that Mum wasn't keen. But this guy was. His name was Jamie. He was the captain of the University of Waikato rowing team. I got to meet him a couple of times and I got really concerned because we had nothing in common at all. He was only 22 years old at the time, so it was a bit of an age gap. He grew up on a farm. I'm from Auckland. I had a paper run when I was growing up. He had a home kill business on the side. The only thing that we had in common was a world record each. I had a world record for rowing 72 hours on a rowing machine at a gym. Jamie had a record for eating a can of Waddy's Big Eat in 3.2 seconds. Now, Jamie had lived in a student flat the last few years. He hadn't seen a lot of food in the same place, not for more than a few seconds. And so we had this huge amount of food to put into the boat, and he managed to resist until we got to the Ernest Adam cakes, and then it was just way too much. Now, I was really concerned because that star doesn't need to be quite as big as that, by the way. I was concerned because I knew something that Jamie didn't know, and that's about a third of all attempts to row across the ocean fail, and in most cases it's because of a breakdown of the relationship of the crew, right? You might not expect that. So just to drive that point home, I've got a list here of the top four worst things actually said from the other rower while at sea. Here we go. Top thing for actually said, I'm going to start with the least worst thing first. Two guys, great mates, out in the middle of the ocean in the first race, one of them turned to the other and said that they didn't make it to the other side. Next thing. Honey, I have a phobia of, what's the worst thing to be afraid of when you're at sea? Some people say it's your teammate calling you honey. No, it's sea. Turns out a third of all people can't stand being in any small boat out of sight of land. Doesn't matter if it's a lifeboat, a rowboat. They just freak out and they can't see land. 2 weeks into the second race, this husband and wife crew, that's where the honey comes from, found the husband was one of them. And he had so much anxiety on the boat that he couldn't stay on board. And so there's one support yacht for the, that patrols the fleet. It took about a week to find them. They came alongside, took him off. But his wife stayed on, and she rowed to the end. It took her 110 days. She got to the end. And the cool thing is, it was the news clip of her arriving at the end that I saw on the news that night that inspired me to take part in the race. This next one's a bit more straightforward. That tattoo, I got it when I was inside. That's a guy finding he's rowing with a convicted murderer. This last one I have to explain. Now, there's two schools of thought about the fastest way to row across the ocean. Some people say you take a southerly route because you get assistance from the wind and the currents. Others say you take a westerly route because that's the shortest. And of course, you can take any angle in between the two. And in the bars before the race, you could hear crews having big debates about this. And then at the start line, we could hear this one crew of our race who just were clearly still having an argument about it. Turns out they never got it resolved. And in one shift, one guy would row south, and in the other shift, while the guy was sleeping, his mate would come out and row west. That's a true story. I met that guy. So we were really concerned, Jamie and I, about how we were going to get on with each other in the race, given this history of things going wrong with crews, and we'd only just met. So we started off with a long list of do's and don'ts. But then we saw that it just boiled down to something very simple. We called it the energy rule. You couldn't do or say anything that was going to reduce the energy level of the team. You couldn't complain, you couldn't whine, you couldn't be sarcastic, you couldn't be late for your shift. Don't do or say anything that was going to reduce the energy level of the team. The boat was going to be a no-moan zone. So if you had any kind of issue to bring up, then you would had to bring a solution as well. And no personal attacks. We didn't have time to make it more sophisticated than that, because just then the gun went off. And that's the pace we kept up for about the first 10 to 15 seconds. So we rowed out of the harbour, and you think it's going to be a big washing machine out there, right? But no, it was absolutely flat. Then we spent the rest of the afternoon rowing the land off into the distance. And then the big hot sun set. It started to get cool. And then the tropical night exploded into 1,000 stars. And I thought, rowing across the ocean, this is going to be awesome. So if day one was the best day of the race, do you want to guess what the worst day was? I'm going to tell you about all of the days individually. No, I'm just kidding. Just day two. So from early in the morning of day two, we started to get a few puffs of wind. And in that morning, it started to build and build and build. Till about lunchtime, it was all we could do with two of us at the oars was to stay in the same spot. We could tell that's all we were doing because of the GPS on the bulkhead just read 00. And because you're not making any ground, you can't use the rudder to steer. So if a wave knocks the bow of the boat, and waves are coming at you from all sides, if a wave knocks the bow, you end up having to do a big circle to bring the boat back round into the wind and waves. Takes a bit longer than this, but you get the idea. And you can feel your bones bending with the effort. You can hear the oars creaking. And you wonder what's going to break first, you or the boat. And what's preying on your mind is you don't actually have to keep on doing this, because you can always put the sea anchor out. Now, it's too deep for a normal anchor, obviously, at sea, but a sea anchor is like a parachute. It goes out the bow of the boat. You lay off a bit of rope, tie it onto the bow, it goes tight, and it pulls the boat into the wind and waves. And now you're kind of safe. You can go to the back cabin, shut the hatch, and ride the storm out. The only problem with doing that is when you're asleep, the boat's slowly drifting backwards. So the big decision was, do we put out the sea anchor or do we keep on rowing? Well, Jamie and I had made it clear to each other our purpose was to win the race, which meant that we're against some pretty tough teams. In particular, these two guys from Auckland who had won the race the previous time, and now they were back. So they were tough guys, they weren't going to stop. If they're not going to stop, that meant we couldn't stop. So we rowed and rowed for the rest of the afternoon as the weather got even worse, then into the night, then throughout this lousy, lousy night. Till finally at lunchtime the next day, things had calmed down just enough for me to be able to get out of my seat, get to the back cabin, grab the sat phone, and call up our shore crew to see how we're doing compared to the rest of the fleet, because we're making to find out. And before we could even ask them, they said, guys, whatever you're doing, keep it up. I said, why? They said, you've got a 25-mile lead on the rest of the fleet. I thought, this is great, we've stayed in the same spot, and now we're 25 miles in front. I said, and why is that? And they said, they've all put their sea anchors out. And when we got to the end of the race, and we won the race, do you want to guess how much we won by? 25 miles. And it wasn't until I was sitting under a palm tree at the end of the race with a glass of rum punch and doing a bit of reflection, and finding the more rum punch, the more reflection, I was thinking, what did we learn on day two? And it was something really simple. All the crews were facing the same storm. All the crews were facing the same seas. We're facing the GFC. We're facing the housing crunch, or we're finding it tough to find tradespeople. The only difference between us and them was a decision that we made that really any of them could have made, and that was to keep on rowing. And that's what made all the difference in the end. Towards the end, on these perfectly hot, calm, still days, but didn't gain a single yard in our competition. The 2 days we gained the most was when the weather turned bad and we kept on rowing. Fortunately, though, it wasn't always like that. Here we are in the second week of the race. I think you can see how those 6 weeks at sea just flew by. If you've ever been in a plane across to Sydney or Melbourne, looked out the window and thought, gosh, there's a lot of water down there. It's twice as far as that. If it seems like there's a lot of water when you're at 30,000 feet and 600 miles an hour, when you're down on the ground going 2 miles an hour, it's really easy to tell yourself that you're never going to get to the other side. But isn't that what every big project feels like? Every big task or every big change that you take on is going to feel like that from 10% of the way through, 1% of the way through, and you can start to see the end again. You've got that big chunk in the middle where it's really easy to let motivation slide away. So what's the answer? You know the answer, but I'll tell you again. You break it down into little steps. So for us rowing across the ocean, that was kind of easy, because all we did was on the top of our Atlantic map, overlaid these 41 curves, and they represent the 41 days of the world record at the time. So now all we have to do every day, every 24 hours, is to row to any point on the next curve, any point on the next curve, or past it, if we could. So now we're not trying to row across 5,000 kilometers of ocean. We're just thinking about things one day at a time. And then eventually you hit the milestones of 10%, 20%, 25%, 33%. And you start to build some mental momentum that way. That worked so well for us that we did the same thing in Antarctica. You start at 80 degrees south, you walk to 90 degrees south. So we marked off the 10 degrees of latitude on the roof of the tent, and they would mark off about an inch each day. And every time we got to a degree, then we'd have a little celebration. In fact, we'd have a little teaspoon of vodka in the hot milk that we had that night. That was quite a treat. This worked very well until Jamie put his pen through the roof of the tent. But more about that soon. In fact, here's the view from the little plane that takes you out to the coast of Antarctica. And it's absolute. The view's amazing. It's awe-inspiring because you know a lot of these peaks haven't been climbed. A lot of them haven't even been named. And the country's big, right? It's vast. It's as big as Australia. But there's nobody there, just the snow that rolls on underneath you, mile after mile, until the last thing you want is for that plane to drop you off. Of course, that's just what it does. So now's the moment of truth. We're about to hook onto that sled for the first time. But that's okay, because you saw how hard we trained. There's going to be a big smile on our face, right? This is what it was like. You can imagine how stupid we felt. We've told all of our family and friends we're going to tow the weight of the fridge from here, from the Novotel at Auckland Airport, down to Wellington and back again. That's about 1,200 k's. Due to a misunderstanding we've had with the pilot of the plane, he's actually dropped us 18 kilometres further north, so he's dropped us in downtown Auckland, and we can't even get out of the car park. And if you've ever been skiing, then you tend to think that a lot of snow in the same place is flat and groomed. It doesn't have to be like that at all. It can be so rough, it's upsetting your sled. Every day, several times a day, I'd turn around and see my sled upside down and go, I wonder how long it's been like that for. But this is a good day because you can see what you're walking on. Once or twice a week, we'd be walking in whiteout conditions like this. We really could not. If you're the person in front, you just cannot see anything in front of you. But you're walking on the same snow, so now you're falling over and the sled's toppling over. It's incredibly frustrating. But this is a good day because you're not tumbling into one of these. A big fear was that on a whiteout day, we wouldn't see it coming. We'd just topple into a crevasse. Turns out I didn't need to be concerned, though, because the crevasse that I fell into was on a fine day, and luckily my ass was a bit bigger than that particular crevasse. Where's Jamie? He's taking the photo. Yes. That's an important point. We're going to be coming back to that. Now, one of the funny things about travelling in Antarctica is you can't take all the food you need for the trip. So even though you're taking 16 Big Macs worth of food every day, you're about 4 Big Macs short from what you should be every day. So by the end of the first week, we were absolutely starving. And wouldn't you know it, Jamie slopped his bowl of muesli onto the floor. Now normally you just push it out into the snow, but not Jamie. He was right down there licking it up off the floor, which worked very well until his tongue stuck to the floor. Who's taking the photo? Yeah, exactly. Now, I started to... One of the funny things about travelling in Antarctica is you know it's going to be cold before you go down there, and yet it's still really cold. Here's the gauge on the sled. It reads minus 34. That's because it doesn't read less than that. It just flashes low, which is really helpful. I started to notice I was getting a funny blue bruise on my leg, and I thought, that's strange. That must be from the sled harness, because you saw what we were like. We're like a dog at a chain trying to pull that sled. Turns out it wasn't the sled harness. It was the wind blowing the Gore-Tex against the thermals against the skin. The cold was coming through and melting away the skin. Oh, that's enough before drinks. So things were really bleak for us in the first couple of weeks when we were down there, and gosh, we felt like we'd bitten off a lot more than we could chew. We really felt maybe we should chuck it in. But we had the rules that worked so well for us out in the Atlantic, this idea of not doing or saying anything that was going to reduce the energy level of the team. It played out a bit differently for us when we were down there, because in the Atlantic you can talk to each other during the day. In the Antarctic you really can't talk to each other until you get into the tent at night. And the temptation when you do is to talk about how bad things are going. And if we did, we knew there was a risk that we'd have talked ourselves out of what we were taking on. So we decided, we tried very hard to, when we got into the tent at night, to only do two things. One of them was to talk about either what was going well, or secondly, what we could put in place to improve things for the next day. The other big lesson we'd learnt from the Atlantic, which we could apply here, was to make that schedule for ourselves. We'd done a schedule before we arrived in Antarctica. When we saw how tough it was, we had to change it up a little bit, relax it near the start, tighten it up near the end. But psychologically, it just helped take the pressure off us. And this was working, it was working fine, but I had another problem that I'm going to mention in case you happen as well, happens to you as well. And that was, I became convinced that my teammate was trying to kill me. Oh, it has happened to you. Yeah. So I'm going to give you some of the facts, and you can tell me whether I'm making too much of this. Jamie started to break things. First, it was just little things. It was just like one day he put the lid on one of the fuel tanks so tight we couldn't get it off. That's okay, we've got some spares. Then there was the day I had my snow goggles on the floor of the tent, and Jamie, he's quite a big bloke, he's selling them, snapped them. Well, that's okay, spare. Then there was the day he was marking off the progress on the roof of the tent too enthusiastically and put his pen through the tent. That's the tent, so it's quite a big deal, but with a bit of duct tape, we can fix it. Then there was the day where it was his job to sweep the tent out to get the snow out of the tent. Last thing we did before we packed to get the snow out. Well, using the little brush was too slow for Jamie, so he picked it up and shook the tent, which worked very well, till he snapped one of the tent poles, which is no fun to replace when it's minus 30 because the metal sticks to your skin. But I'm not saying anything though. I would be lying to say the resentment wasn't building up about his poor attitude. But I'm not saying anything. We've got the energy rule. But then he took it to a whole different level. One of the most important things you can have in Antarctica is a working stove. Because you need the stove to melt the ice, give you water, heat the tent, cook the food. You don't survive long without a stove. So we had three stoves, one good one and two spares. So the second most important thing is the lighter, which Jamie would wear around his neck to keep it warm and so he knew where it was. So what's the worst thing to hear when you crawl into the tent one night? Except he didn't put it like that. He said, "Have you seen the lighter?" I said, "No, but you must have it though, because the stove's on." He goes, "Yeah, no, I must have it. I just can't put my hand on it." So we slowly start looking under a few things, end up turning the tent upside down, cannot find this lighter. He goes, "Oh, well, it's got to show up." I'm like, "Man, it's got to show up." I lift the lid off the pot, and there it is, boiling inside. He's going to kill us. Oh, he doesn't mean to kill us, but his bad attitude is going to result in like a sabotage of the campaign. He's just breaking too many things. Eventually he's going to break something that we can't replace, and that's going to be the end of us. So I'm in a bit of a problem because I'm pretty wound up about this, but I can't, and I don't want to say anything, at least not say anything in a way that's going to be unhelpful. And, you know, we've got the energy rule. You don't say anything that's going to reduce the energy level of the team, but I don't trust myself to say anything in such a way that it's not going to cause a big explosion. And it seems like a bad idea to piss off the only bloke within 1,000 miles because I quite need him to get to the pole. So I'm not saying anything, but the resentment is building up inside. And this all got resolved in a strange way. one of the toughest things to do in Antarctica is how to occupy your head in the 10 to 12 hours a day you're on the trail. If any of you think life is rushing by, I really recommend a trip to Antarctica because it slows to a complete crawl. I used to look forward to the last 20 minutes of the last shift of the day. We'd do about 6 to 8 80-minute shifts, but the last 20 minutes near the end of the day, I'd finally let myself do what I've been wanting to do all day, and that's count down to the end. So that would be 1200, 1199, 1198. The only thing keeping us sane was this trick we'd learned out of the Atlantic, and that was to listen to audiobooks on your iPod to make time go past. Actually, the real trick is to listen to non-fiction audiobooks about people in a worse off situation than yourself. That's what's really happening. So this was working great down here until day 12. Day 12 I'll never forget, because on that day, I crawled into the tent, patted myself down, couldn't find my iPod. I'd lost it out on the trail. If any of you are planning to do this trip yourself, my one piece of advice for you, don't take a white iPod to Antarctica. They're really hard to find. But then Jamie, without a moment's thought, said, "That's okay, mate, you can share mine." And suddenly I realised his attitude hadn't been bad. His attitude had been fine. But he had been breaking things. The person with the bad attitude was me, because I was so obsessed with how wrong he was and how right I was that I couldn't have a simple conversation with him about how to make the tent a safer place. And since I've come back, I've learned I'm not the only one who makes this mistake. In fact, it's got a fancy name. It's called the fundamental attribution error. And the idea behind it is we judge other people's mistakes differently from our own mistakes. So when you make a mistake, you tend to blame external circumstances. If your teammate or your employee makes a mistake, you tend to blame their personality. So if you're late to work, it's because the traffic was bad and your alarm clock didn't work. If your teammate's late to work, it's because they're slack. Now, they might be slack, but we tend to go there a bit too quick. The three bastards rule is just an easy way to remember the same thing. It goes like this. If you meet more than three bastards in the same day, it may not be them. That's the bastard. So poor Jamie, I'd been meeting more than his share of bastards on the way down, and once I knew what I was doing, then we could have a simple conversation about how to make the tent a safer place. A few days after this, I was talking to Mum on the phone. She said, "How are things going?" I said, "Not very good. I've lost my iPod." She said, "That's okay, dear. Keep an eye out for it on the way back."
Should work. Why not?
On to the last one now. On to the last one. It's play the final whistle. This is about persistence. You know, if things are going well, you've got to keep the pressure up, because often Murphy's Law wants to kick in. If things are going badly, if you keep the pressure up, often you can get things back on track. And that's where Jamie and I found ourselves. We're 3/4 of the way across the ocean. We've lost our lead to those two guys from Auckland. And we'd been trying to catch them the last couple of weeks, and nothing had seemed to work. These guys are now 70 miles in front. That's a whole day's worth of rowing in front if they were going to stop. And there's no way they're going to stop, because we're only about 10 days out from the end. And like I say, we've been trying to catch. Every night we'd put in a huge piece of work to try and catch them, and it really hadn't worked. We'd gain a few miles one night, we'd lose a few miles the next night. All we'd done is proven to ourselves is that we really didn't have a show of catching them. And the only reason we're having this conversation 10 days out from the end is we were down to our last chance. If this really was our last chance to try and catch them, do we even try? So we're having this discussion one night. And Jamie thought, you know, it was worth trying. I said, "Why?" He says, "I think we can win this race." I said, "Why?" He said, "No, I think we can win." I said, "Yeah, but why?" He said, "Yeah, I think we can win." I said, "Yeah, but why?" He said, "Because they've got two guys from Auckland on their boat. We've only got one on ours." So we couldn't row any harder, but we could row longer. So we started to do these crazy shifts. We'd row an hour and a half on, half hour off. In that half hour at night time, you had to get up out of your seat, get your clothes off, get to the back cabin, have something to eat, get some sleep, but then wake up in time to get dressed and get back on the oars. So you've got very little sleep, and none of it in a big chunk. So the real risk is that you would fall asleep when you're alone at the oars and the boat would stop. We had a couple of different ways of trying to avoid that. One of them was we had a rough piece of cable tie at the very end of one of the oars, and so you could work your finger up and down the cable tie and rip away at the skin a little bit. That worked quite well. The other way was the slapping game. Only one rule to the slapping game. Can you all make the rowing motion, please? And you can never stop when you're at the oars. You can't stop. You've got to put the slap on in between. Here we go. You tell me when you want them to stop, Tony. Because you know you're going to do it. It's harder than it looks. You know you're going to do it, so you flinch. You have to brace yourself. Anyway, Danny must have heard me doing this one night because he starts shouting out, harder, harder. He should have been asleep, he was in the back cabin. Anyway, he starts shouting out, harder, harder. I'm like, that's really funny, but what's he doing to stay awake? What's old Gen Y up to? So sure enough, at about 4 o'clock in the morning, that same night, I wake up because I can't hear anything. Normally you can always hear the ka-chunk, ka-chunk of the oars. I thought, oh no, what's happened out there? So I opened up the hatch. This is what I saw. It's Jamie, asleep at the oars. So we started to catch up with the other guys, until we're neck and neck, about 120 miles out from the end. On this afternoon, we're getting pushed along by huge swells. It's fantastic. Till the sun sets. If anything, the swells get larger. You know what happens. That big wave comes. And even before the wave stopped pushing me down, I'm swimming to the top, because the worst thing I could think of would be to get to the top and seeing the boat being carried away by the next wave. Because, you know, something like that's just what's happened to those six boats lost at sea. But luckily, I get to the top. The boat's right there. It's the right way up. I can't see Jamie, though. That's because I found it afterwards. I'm standing on his shoulders. But then he clambers up on the other side of the boat, gets in, and then we've just got a few seconds to get all the things that have been thrown off the boat that are now bobbing away into the dark while the waves are coming over us. I've got a few seconds to throw them up onto the boat before they drift away. And I find almost all the things we need, except for two really crucial things. And one of them was one of the rowing seats, because you know how the seats have little wheels, you get to use your legs. Without that seat, we'd lost the use of one person's legs. And I was really upset. I thought, oh no, we've lost about a knot worth of speed. We've choked right at the very end. And Jamie was upset by that, but possibly distracted by the fact that he had been rowing in the Nudd, as you do. He had his one pair of shorts on the side to dry. They'd gone over. He was gonna have to finish the race in the Nude. I can see none of you are looking forward to the next slide. actually, fortunately for all of us, Jamie's a very resourceful guy. He managed to find the one long john top that we had, cut the sleeves off it, put his legs into the sleeves, and because of the collar, he even gave himself a little fly. Did quite a good job. Not sure what this bloke's up to. Yeah. Managed to survive another night, come out to do my shift, even though it's 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm in pitch black. I'm really excited because I know what's going to happen next. And sure enough, even before the sun comes up, you start to see the white band on the horizon. Then you see the silhouette of land. And then greenery. We've only been blue for so long. And then to smell the smell of land. And then to see the smiles on the faces of the people as we rode down the coastline. It was absolutely magical. So we get to the end. We win the race. We break the world record. There's a huge, noisy crowd to wish us well on the pier. But then the crowd suddenly goes quiet. And split in two, and this beautiful princess-like creature appeared in the sparkly swimsuit and got aboard the boat and made particular good friends with Jamie. He was a very affectionate guy, and he has been 6 weeks at sea. But I don't think that quite explains his judgment in this case. So for those of you at the back, I'll explain. There's two things wrong with this picture. The first is that Jamie is 6'4". And the other is, of course, is there's two men in it. And we tried to explain this to Jamie, but he wasn't having it. I have Jamie in his own words what the next hour of his life was like.
I arrived in Barbados and realised after we got told after an hour that being kissed by what I thought was a 6'6" woman was actually a man.
Let's go on to the end of the South Pole trek, because surely it can't be worse. Here we are on Christmas Day. It's a happy and a sad day for us. Happy because well, we're only a week out from the end. It's about day 45 of our trip. A week out from the end. Happy because Jingle Bells makes a lot more sense when there's snow outside. Sad because Jamie had pulled his hamstrings in that rough snow that you saw early on. He'd walked 1,000 k's in them since. The pain had gotten worse and worse, and it became clear on Christmas Day that we were going to be able to make it to the South Pole, but we weren't going to be able to make the trip back. So I had a lot of time to think as I walked that last week to the pole about what we had achieved and what we hadn't achieved, and if we had failed. Of course we had failed, because we weren't going to do what we said that we would do. And that really stung. We had a lot invested in that. But I got some comfort from a quote I could half recall that was going through my head. It goes like this. The tragedy in our lives is not that we set our goals so high that we sometimes fall short. It's that we keep setting our goals so low so that we'll always reach them. When you set yourself a big goal outside your comfort zone, you're not worthwhile, because even if you fall short, you're going to be dropped off much further along than you would have been, right, if you had no goal in the first place. When you think about it, the real point of a goal is that it sets a course for yourself, and it's a tool to get the most out of yourself. And we'd certainly done that. Let me quickly go through the points that I've raised so far. At the start, I talked about the flinch you sometimes feel when you set yourself a big challenge. And talked about the two antidotes to that was getting an image. And science says, in fact, it should be an image of you overcoming an obstacle on the way to success. I talked about if you can foresee anything that's going to make it difficult or painful or hard, that's fantastic, because then you can do something about it beforehand to make it more comfortable and more pleasant. I talked about choosing to win or planning to win, so starting with the end in mind with your objective and being clear about that and working backwards from there rather than just trying to do what you normally do every day a little bit more. I talked about the energy rule, the no-moan zone, not doing or saying anything that's going to reduce the energy level of the team, and the three bastards rule, which in a nutshell is about not believing the stories that come into your head for why people do the things that they do. You might be right, but you might be wrong. The only way to take anything, any big challenge on is to break it into little parts. And I hope you remember also the story of the sea anchor, and that if it's tough for you, it's tough for everybody else. And if you can keep on persisting during that time, then you can get a big jump on the competition. Wasn't long before Jamie and I found ourselves at the base of the last little hill, looking up at the circle of flags. And I could just make out, you might be able to see the few pixels, which is the top of the South Pole. It looks like a mirror. Mirror ball on top of a barbershop pole, just like it should. So I'm marching up the hill. I could just see it for the first time. And so things are going great. But then Jamie flings out his hand and says, wait. I'm like, what? He says, what's the chances of there being any girls in bikinis at the end of this trip? I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, oh, no, you're fine. Even with your lack of judgment in these things, you're absolutely fine. We're in the South Pole. There aren't many girls in tops. And I was completely wrong. This is a true story. If I had more time, I'll explain to you what they're doing here. But the key thing to take away, guys, is just when you think you're tough, girls are doing it in togs. Here's what it was actually like when we arrived at the South Pole a couple of hours earlier. And it's an amazing feeling. I mean, initially of the relief of the 52 days of pain that's finally stopped. But you know what it's like when you set yourself a big task. And at the start, you identify the risks and you address them as much as you can. And you keep on persisting, even on those days you want to chuck it in. And you get there. In the end, it's not just a good feeling, it's the best feeling in the world because you feel like you can take on anything then. So here we are, the first Kiwis to walk unsupported and unresupplied to the South Pole, and because we towed almost all the food and fuel we needed for the return trip, probably the team that's pulled the most weight the furthest distance for no particular good reason. Just want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. Jamie and I were thinking a lot about our family and friends when we were down there, and on the way to the pole, Jamie decided that he would make the ultimate commitment when he got home. So he said, Kev, take this picture of me with a sign with the South Pole, which says, please say yes. I'll get it blown up into a poster, and I'll use it when I propose to my girlfriend, Kate. And I'm very pleased to say that he did use this picture. She did say yes. It's the same picture he uses now when he wants to go on hunting trips. Now, I hope there's some more snacks coming out with the drinks. My advice for you is eat them all. I don't have the South Pole diet, I've got the South Beach diet, I've got the South Pole diet. So if any of you go home tonight looking like this, don't be afraid. In 50 days, I can make you 50 pounds lighter. The worst thing about it though, is he scared those girls away. Guys, I wish you all the best for another fantastic year, but there will be some tough times as well. When they come, remember you've got a choice. You can either put out your sea anchor or set a course to the edge of your comfort zone and keep on rowing. Thank you very, very much.